so forth, in verses 6 through 8 of Genesis chapter 1. So if you look permanently in Genesis 1, you read verses 6 through 8. And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made a firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven in the evening and the morning or the second day. We'll give our attention to Brother Adam.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning.
No, I forgot yesterday. I want to extend my thanks, I'm sure everybody here has, to the brothers who have taken on the work of putting on this gathering again. It was missed for 2 years. I know after the storm and the Sanders weren't able to take care of it anymore, and we're certainly appreciative of having it here, Paul, and time of the year that it does, when we have a little bit of break between our gatherings and Bible schools, it's nice to have that kind of a central meeting point between southern ecclesias and some of the northern southern ecclesias. So at any rate, with that, we're going to start this second day concerning the creation of the firmament, which was later named heaven. And again, we want to remember and keep these things in our mind as we go forward, because a lot of the principles that we set forth, they apply to every day of the week as far as the Elohim said. We can keep the principles that we discussed concerning the Elohim. We keep the principles we discussed about the fact that it's by the word of Elohim, or the word of Yahweh, that proceeds from Him, and causes them to create all things. It is by His word that each of these steps of development takes place. This is again the second day of bounding, setting boundaries, dividing, separating, before the work commences of decorating, adorning, and furnishing, subsequent to the birth of the land out of the water. Pounding out of the face of the earth, the creation of the mountains and valleys. The earth is born out of the water, and subsequently it's capable of bringing forth fruit. In verse 6 we read that Elohim said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters. The word firmament is derived from a Latin word meaning to support or make firm. As far as the actual Hebrew word is concerned, it is in the Hebrew rakia, R-A-Q-I-Y-A. And it's literally translated an expanse or an expanded surface. I'm not sure that the word firmament from the Latin, the way that it's derived out of the Latin, is an appropriate word to translate rakia from, because rakia means this expanse or an expanded surface, and firmament means to support or make firm. But there is an idea that we'll get into, that the clouds or that the heavenly waters that sit upon this expanse are actually supported by this. That's kind of an idea that's presented in some of the scriptures that we'll look at. So you can take that how you will. But literally the word firmament from the Hebrew would be better understood to be an expanse or an expanded surface. It's from the root word raqa, R-A-Q-A, which means to pound or to expand by hammering, to beat out, to stretch out. And it has particular reference if we look at Isaiah 40, verse 19. Particular reference to the expanding of a metal, particularly gold or silver, to overlay another object, wood or whatever you're going to overlay with this metal. Isaiah 40, Verse 19. It says, the workman melteth the graven image, and the goldsmith spreadeth it over with gold and casteth silver change. That spreadeth it over, or spreadeth it, is from the Hebrew raka, R-A-Q-A, and it means, it is that root word for rakia, from which this firmament is derived. So we see this spreading out by hammering to overlay something. Now this expanse back in Genesis 1, this expanse created in the midst of the waters is later called heaven. We read in verse 8, God called the firmament heaven. The Elohim called the firmament heaven. But it is obviously not the heavens created in the beginning, which we read in verse 1. In the beginning, God created, the Elohim created the heaven and the earth. This is obviously a different, a heaven that's to be differentiated from that heaven that was created in the beginning, because it was obviously that heaven was in existence already. Nor is it the heaven of which Brother Tommy will talk, the lights were placed in verses 14. God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide day from night. This firmament, or this heaven, exists between the waters within the atmosphere of the earth. And consequently, we know that the sun and the moon and the stars are not hung within the atmosphere of the earth. So it's obviously that that's to be distinguished. The word rakia, which again is the word firmament in the King James Version, occurs 17 times in the Old Testament, and the expanse to which it refers in each of these 17 places must be determined by the context. I'm not going to go over all the places that it appears, but it's used in Ezekiel 1 and 10, I can think of off the top of my head, to refer to the expanse that was above the cherubim that he saw in vision. The expanse between their wings, I think, is the way that it's described as in Ezekiel 1 and chapter 10. It can be, consequently, a confined expanse, as it is in this verse, the expanse between earth and clouds, the expanse above the cherubim, or it can be an essentially unlimited one, as outer space in which were placed the lights of the day and night. Let's look at Job 38. It would appear from this process of creation, and it's evident from this passage we're going to read, that at the time of creation, there was a dense fog covering the waters. As we discussed yesterday, the face of the earth was covered in water, probably miles deep. And then upon the face of this water was this cloud, what we would call a cloud or a dense fog. Let's look at Job 38, verse 8. It reads, who shut up the sea with doors when it break forth as if it had issued out of a womb. This is Yahweh now speaking to Job. When I made the cloud the garment thereof, that is, over this water, and thick darkness a swaddling band for it, and break up for it my decree place, and set bars and doors, and said, hitherto shalt thou come, but no further, and here shall thy proud waves be stayed. And that more pertains to the third day. So our focus here is that it was this cloud was made the garment of the waters. We have the earth covering water, and then the cloud made a garment covering that water. And darkness penetrating all the complete darkness, as we discussed yesterday. Yeah. was created between the ocean and this cloud. This expanse elevated and held up or supported the cloud, all the waters above the firmament in verse 7. Elohim made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. So we don't want to have in our mind any idea that there was another ocean separated above the firmament in the heavens, but it was this cloud or water vapor that was referred to as the waters above the firmament or above heaven. So this division was created between terrestrial or earthbound waters and celestial waters, the water vapor that rose above the firmament. Let's look at Job 37. Job 37:18. And here's, I think, where this idea that we talked about the firmament supporting the cloud. Job 37:18. Hast thou with him spread out the sky? Remember that idea that's involved in the word of rakia, of pounding out a metal, expanding it by pounding it out, whose hast thou with him spread out the sky, which is strong and as a molten looking glass. It can be seen through. And I'll mention, I don't want to tread here too much on Brother Asbell's material, but there's an interesting article Brother Jim Horton wrote. It's in the Advocate this month. And he discusses in there the narrow spectrum of light that the atmosphere is transparent to. And we see that mentioned by, in Job 37 here, strong and as a molten looking glass. We can see clearly through it. But there's really, as far as light is concerned, there's a wide spectrum of light, but it's really a narrow window that is actually transparent in the atmosphere. If it were transparent to all life, then life would be destroyed, because you've got ultraviolet and ultraviolet light involved that destroys life. And that's all I'm going to say on that. Let's look also at Job 26, verse 7. He stretcheth out the north over the empty place, and hangeth the earth upon nothing. He bindeth up the waters in his thick clouds, and the cloud is not rent under them. And also, Psalm 104. You see these clouds of water, this water vapor being condensed into clouds above the heaven. Psalm 104, verse 2. Who coverest thyself with light as with a garment, who stretcheth out the heavens like a curtain. There we see that stretching out, that expanding by pounding out, we believe, of heavens. Who layeth the beams of his chambers in the waters, who maketh the clouds his chariot, who walketh upon the wings of the wind. And there's a lot involved in these verses that we don't have time to get into. There's some more typical significance or symbolic significance to the things that we're reading here, making clouds his chariot. We're all thinking in our minds probably of the cherubim as the chariot of the Lord, and the clouds which he'll be seen coming with, and how they enter into the picture of the cherubim in the first chapter of Revelation. And we don't have time to deal with all that right now. But we can see the heavens stretched out like a curtain, the beams of his chamber above the waters. He laid the beams of his chambers in the waters, obviously the waters above the heavens, because he dwells in the heavens beyond the expanse between the earthly and celestial waters, or the clouds. Look also at Isaiah 42. Isaiah 42, 42 verse 5. Thus saith God, Yahweh, He that created the heavens and stretched them out, He that spread forth the earth and that which cometh out of it, He that giveth breath unto the people upon it and spirit to them that walk therein. See that stretching out of the heavens again. And turn also to Isaiah 44. Isaiah 44 verse 24. Thus saith Yahweh, thy Redeemer, and He that formed thee from the womb, I am Yahweh that maketh all things, that stretcheth forth the heavens alone, that spreadeth abroad the earth by myself. Now in these passages, if you went and looked into it later, you would find that this word that's been used for the spreading abroad of the earth is also related to that root, makah, and means that pounding
of this expanse or heavens between the earthly waters and the heavenly waters. That word's applied to both of those things. And our main concern here is He stretched forth the heavens alone. By Himself He stretched forth the heavens, or by the sending forth of His Word. And our final reference on this is going to be in Jeremiah 51. Jeremiah 51, verse 15. He hath made the earth by His power, He hath established the world by His wisdom, and hath stretched out the heaven by His understanding. When He uttereth His voice, there is a multitude of waters in the heavens. And He causeth the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth. He maketh lightnings with rain, and bringeth forth the wind out of His treasures. So we see He stretches forth the heavens. When He utters His voice, there's waters in the heavens. The vapors ascend from the earth and form this waters above the heaven. Now let's see what we're looking at here. Okay. The expanse that was created on this second day, I don't know. For sure, I would think that this entire atmosphere was created on the second day. If the atmosphere existed in some form and was molded into the shape that it is right now, that's possible as well. Whatever the case was, this, what's called the troposphere right here, this lowest level, on the atmosphere. In fact, I think it's that yellow line's too high to get it off of there. This where it says tropopause right here is that light blue area, or that darker blue area between the light and the darker blue. That is what we believe to be termed the expanse that is between the waters. That layer of the atmosphere is where the clouds are formed. It's all the clouds are formed within that layer of the atmosphere. That layer, the troposphere, extends, as you can see there, 14 to 18 kilometers out from the surface of the earth, depending on where you are on the globe. That's equal to those who speak English here. It's 8 to 11 miles out from the Earth's surface. This segment of the atmosphere, this layer of the atmosphere, accounts for 80% of the entire mass of the atmosphere. And we kind of, best way for me to understand it is it counts for 80% of the entire weight of all that atmosphere. That extends out to the what's finally called the exosphere, I believe, that's beyond that chart. 80% of the weight is in that lowest level. It is the most dense portion of air in our atmosphere. As you can see here, and this isn't, I'm not just putting this up here for no reason. It factors in here in a minute. The atmosphere, that air is composed primarily, as you can see in the top, this top pie graph, is the total composition, and then we have a smaller pie on the bottom, which is just a minute portion of that larger graph. So it's primarily composed of nitrogen and oxygen with a little bit of argon, and then the rest of it's primarily, that narrow part is primarily carbon dioxide and several other minor things that make up this atmosphere. Now, this air, dry, primarily composed of this nitrogen and oxygen, the NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, has determined, and I'm taking their word, they're the scientists, they found that dry air of that form in the troposphere, that lowest layer of the atmosphere, has a density of about 1/7,000 of a kilogram per square meter. Just follow me just for a minute. Now, the density of a cloud or of water vapor infused air is about 1/3,000 of a kilogram per square meter. I should have put this where you could see it. So you've got 1.007 for dry air is the mass or the weight of dry air. 1.003, slightly less, not much, but slightly less for the weight of that water vapor infused air or cloud segment. Now, as the water vapor in the air condenses, it forms clouds. We see clouds. And as clouds condense, the water droplets in those clouds condense, they grow larger, and they consequently weigh more. As they grow in size, they weigh more and they fall to the ground as rain. But in vapor form, individual water particles weigh slightly less than this dry air. Okay? Consequently, they're able to, because of their slightly less weight, they're able to, with the movement of the air, move above the air. With the updrafts, the air moving around, the air carries them up and they form clouds when they condense in the sky, what we see as clouds. Now, what you see here is kind of, it's the best thing that I could find to kind of demonstrate this visually. You see, did I turn this off? There it is. You see this cloud? That's a cloud, that dark area right there. And then, of course, the surface of the earth is curved, so we can see in the distance clouds curving around the surface of the earth. But from the side, we're looking at this cloud. Under that is what we would term the troposphere. And in reality, the troposphere extends up to about this kind of pinkish line right here. But the air is the most dense. Once you've moved, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but once you've moved halfway through the troposphere, you've passed through 50% of the mass of the atmosphere. You talk to me about that later. So the clouds don't rise all the way to the top of that of the troposphere because the air is 50% lighter up here than it is midway through. They're going to float where they fall most, where they level out in that where their weight is able to be supported. Okay? I got an example here that hopefully will kind of make this easier to understand. It was hard for me to grasp at first. Now, clouds are formed primarily by evaporation from bodies of water from the ocean. It was only the ocean that existed right at first that would have formed these clouds. It is formed by evaporation, the heat working on the oceans, evaporating water from them. The rest of the moisture, it's primarily from that bodies of water evaporating. The rest of it is formed by transpiration from plants. Okay, so and the way that breaks down is approximately 90% comes from evaporation, 10% comes from transpiration off of the leaves of plants. Atmospheric water, or the clouds, the water vapor in the atmosphere, accounts for 1/1000th of 1% of the entire water in the earth. Okay, and these are all things that are going to enter in when we consider the spiritual development of the that's allegorically involved in this creation week. So kind of think about these things, and they're already coming to your mind. It accounts for 1/1000th of a percent of the entire earth's water, and it accounts for 4/100ths of 1% of fresh water in the atmosphere, in the earth. Okay? U.S. Geological Survey says that 1 acre of corn can transpire 3,000 to 4,000 gallons of water a day, which was kind of surprised me. I didn't realize that. Transpiration happens by the plants taking water through their roots and they pass it up. It carries the nutrients. We know how that all works. The water comes up through the roots and it carries the nutrients through the plants, and the water goes out to their leaves, and before the water falls off, it's transpired or evaporated off the leaves into the atmosphere. So an acre of corn can transpire 3,000 to 4,000 gallons a day. And a large oak tree, they say, can transpire 40,000 gallons per year, which is, you know, you think about that, that's a lot of water. It surprised me anyway. Now, as we said, evaporation is accomplished by the sun instilling enough heat or energy into a water molecule to make it break its bond with surrounding molecules. We have a body of water, and they have a natural tendency to cohere to one another. We discussed these atoms and stuff yesterday. They have a natural tendency to cohere to one another, these water molecules. But the sun has to instill enough energy into that body of water, and it happens at the surface of the body of water, to excite that water molecule enough to break its natural bond and elevate into the heavens, okay? The water molecule, having been dissociated from the larger body of water, is elevated through the expanse. As we said, they have a natural tendency to slowly float to a certain point through that troposphere, but it's accelerated by the updrafts of the winds on the earth. Now, I'm going to make an example here, and some of you might not be able to see it in the back. I borrowed this coat. I'm not going to say who it's from because I don't want to embarrass my mom. But if you can see in this light, you're not going to be able to see it up here. But if you bang this, you can see dust particles that appear basically to be floating in the air. That is how these water droplets do. And if you move the air, it carries them up. Now, they're not as light as a water molecule, but that's a rough example of what's happening. These water molecules in smaller form are able to, what appears to be, float with that dust. And as the air moves upon them, it carries them upward. Another example would be of this, why the water moves to the top of the atmosphere. If we had a jug here, we could pour water in it and pour oil on top of it, or we could pour oil in it and pour water on top of that. The oil, because it's a lighter material, moves to the top of that water. And that's basically what's happening, and it's accelerated by the updrafts of the air. Is that right, Sam?
Yep.
Thank you. Now, that water moves up into the heavens, and it condenses with more water vapor in the upper part of the troposphere, forming what we view as clouds. And this must have been the process on the second day. We know that the sun was not visibly present. More than likely, it was invisibly present, creating this heat that was sufficiently forming this water vapor. And the cloud that was present on the first day, that cloud again was present on the first day, and it was just elevated on the second day, or the expanse was formed under it. So we have here, we'll move on to the with that natural understanding there, or the literal creation that took place on the first day, to the symbolic prophecy of the second millennium of creation from 3000 to 2000 BC. Now, as we see on this chart that I found out Brother Robbie made years ago, I wondered where I got it for years. I don't know how I got it, but at any rate, he mentions here on the bottom, it's written out there, in 2438 BC, I'm sure that's an approximate date, we have the flood, and then in 2142 BC we see Abram being called. So it was in this millennium that we witnessed, or the earth witnessed, the destruction of the earth, or the people of it, by a flood, the division of the earth, or its people again, and tongues as a result of the work at the Tower of Babel, and we also see the calling out of Abraham and the covenant made with him. Let's look at 2 Peter 3. Second Peter 3, verse 5. For this they willingly are ignorant of, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of water, out of the water and in the water, whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. But the heavens and the earth, which are now, by the same word which created these waters and caused it to stand in and out of the water, the heavens and the earth, which are now, are kept by that same word in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. Turn over to 1 Peter 3. Verse 20. Which sometimes were disobedient, when once the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was a preparing, wherein few, that is, eight souls, were saved by water. Now, do you remember what we said, that the atmospheric water accounts for 1/1000th of 1% of the entire earth's water? We have here eight souls, eight lives, eight individuals that were saved in the days of the flood. So we can see that corresponding there, this in this separation of water, separation of peoples. We'll get into the representation of the oceans and such in a minute. Hebrews 11, verse 7. Hebrews 11, verse 7. By faith Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. So we see this separation of Noah. I'm not going to read the actual account of it. It's in Genesis 10:32 if you want to write that down or look at it later. Now, the division of the peoples of the earth. Look over, we're going to go to Genesis 10:25. This was subsequent to the flood, we know, when the people gathered together, they were all of one language. They're going to build this tower to reach unto heaven. Genesis 10:25. Unto Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, which means division. For in his days was the earth divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. Now turn over to 11. Verse 6, and see what was referred to there. This is expanding upon what was said of the division of the earth in the days of Peleg. Genesis 11, verse 6, Yahweh said, Behold, the people is one, and they have all one language, and this they begin to do, building this tower. And now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So Yahweh scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because Yahweh did there confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did Yahweh scatter them abroad upon the face of the earth. So we have there the segregation, the separation of the people, and the division of the languages. Now, we have also in that millennium the call of Abraham over in Genesis 12. And this is, of course, this process of separation went on through this millennium. We have the flood, saved 8 souls from Shem, Ham, and Japheth, where the earth was repeopled. We have the division of their children here in chapter 11 at the Tower of Babel and the casting of them all throughout the earth, and the division of language. And then out of that division comes this next division of Abraham being called out. One individual from the nations of the earth. Genesis 12, verse 1. Now Yahweh had said unto Abram, Get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto a land that I will show thee, and I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee and curse him that curseth thee, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. So Abram departed as Yahweh had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. One person out of all the people of the earth is called, and out of him is going to be created. With him, all the other water molecules are going to have to condense, right, to partake in these promises. In him would be the blessings. Look over at Hebrews 11 again, verse 8. Hebrews 11, verse 8. By faith Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing whither he went. By faith he sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Both Noah and Abram were called out of the nations and separated to Yahweh. And this separation of people unto Yahweh was, as we know, a work that commenced early in history. And that's testified of in Acts 15. Let's turn there to Acts 15. Acts 15, verse 13. And after they had held their peace, James answered, saying, Men and brethren, hearken unto me. Simeon hath declared how God at the first did visit the Gentiles to take out of them. Remember that word that appears there, ek in the Greek, out of, and it's translated here literally, to take out of them a people for his name. Visits the Gentiles to take out of them a people for his name. We'll make the point on that a little bit later, but remember that phrase. So just as atmospheric water accounts for a minute portion of all the earth's water, 8 people out of the entire population of the earth were saved out of the flood. Abraham was one man called upon to leave all behind, but out of him are all the clouds to be formed. Okay, with him, all the other water molecules that are called through the heavens that separate from the waters of the earth have to condense with him. Okay, now we're going to move on to this spiritual development leg of this day of creation. It is the second step. First, we have to have... Look, you can't have any... You can't go through any of these steps if you don't first have a knowledge of the Word, right? We can't get anywhere. You can't have faith if you don't hear. Isn't that the argument presented in the Scriptures? You have to hear before you can understand and have faith in it. So we have that revelation of the light upon the earth as an we're looking at this as an individual and his spiritual development in six stages. The second step, another step, as we said, of separation or division before that third step of separation, as we said, being born out of the water, the earth being born out of the water. But there's a step that has to come before that. Now, the ungodly, ignorant, and wicked masses of the earth are symbolically represented by seas or oceans. Let's look at Isaiah 57. Now, the schedule said go to 9:50. Is that right? 9:50? Yeah? Okay. Isaiah 57, verse 20. The wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. There is no peace, saith my God, to the wicked. So we see the wicked as this troubled sea moving about, an agitated sea. And you'll remember in that first day when we discussed the word day, the word yom is a picture in the Hebrew language of a hand, meaning work, and water. So we see this working of the water, and that is that sun that agitates that fluid. But the wicked themselves, we can see here, are like the troubled sea. They cannot rest. They're always about seeking after some way to cause stumbling. The wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. That's all they can do in their natural state. Revelation 17. We're all familiar with this, but we're just going to look at it quickly here. Revelation 17, verse 1. There came one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, Come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters. That many waters is what we want to keep in mind here. And turn down to verse 15. He saith unto me, The waters which thou sawest, where the whore sitteth, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. There again we have the nations, the wicked masses, represented by the waters or the oceans. Look at Psalm 18. Psalm 18, verse 4. David here writes, The sorrows of death compassed me, and the floods of ungodly men made me afraid. So we have the ungodly men related to a flood here. And Psalm 124 will be the last proof of this we'll look at. Psalm 124, verse 2. If it had not been Yahweh who was on our side when men rose up against us, then they had swallowed us up quick when their wrath was kindled against us. Then the waters had overwhelmed us. The stream had gone over our soul. Then the proud waters had gone over our soul. Blessed be Yahweh who hath not given us as a prey to their teeth. And he goes on there as being, he relates this deliverance from wicked men who were rising up against him, as deliverance from waters that would have overwhelmed him. Now these masses are carried about by the lust of the eye, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life, right? It's all that's in the world is the lust of the eye, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. Now they have a trick that they pull though, because they rename these things, the lust of the eye, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life, with things that sound more appealing, such as ambition, right? We have ambition, which is going after the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and it's the pride of life that causes one to seek after those things. The pursuit of happiness, liberty, fraternity, equality, These are all tied up in the Constitution of the United States and throughout most of the world. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Isn't that what the United States supposedly stands for? So we have these lust of the eye, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life renamed with these more noble ideas and presented as things that are to be desired, not things that God, as we discussed yesterday, He's declared them to be this, and all that we have to do, there's not an option for us. All we can do is accept what He declares them to be. That is evil. The lust of the eye, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. Solomon says in Proverbs 4:16, "They sleep not except they have done mischief, and their sleep is taken away unless they cause some to fall." And they go about in any means that they can. They rename abominable things as, and they call it, instead of an abominable lifestyle, they call it an alternative lifestyle, don't they? And instead of desiring to murder innocent unborn children, they call it pro-choice, a woman's right. Okay? And that's the way that they go about to cause some to fall. They try to distract people and rename things. Now, it's upon individuals in this earthly water, in this oceanic mass, that the light of the Word shines, inviting them out of the wandering masses. And as we read in Acts 15, God did visit the Gentiles to take out of them a people for His name. He didn't aim to convert the whole mass of water into a celestial fluid, did He? He aimed to take out of that water, out of those masses, a people for His name. Not the entire conversion of the world, but to take out of the world a people for His name. Whoa. Upon these, as individual water molecules, the light of the truth shines. Their ability, the individual's ability, to be energized enough to break their natural bond, their natural cohesion that we talked about, of water to water. Their ability to be energized enough to break the natural bond they have with the masses is based upon the extent of their exposure to the Word, to the light. Okay? If we're not exposed to the Word, if we're not exposed to the light, we're not going to be energized to the point of separation from this mass. Now, such an interest in the Word and the purpose of Yahweh causes us to associate with those whose sole desire is to obtain a place in the kingdom He intends to establish on the earth, doesn't it? When we understand that Word, we're caused to, and we have a desire to look further into that, we have a natural tendency, we should have a tendency, to gather with those who have that same interest. We consequently should begin to separate ourselves from our worldly associates. This draws us towards the other individuals who have also been called out of that mass. Now, as we discussed, we recognize the clouds are used to represent the multitudinous Christ at His second coming. I don't think that's what's represented in this stage of creation, because we don't see that final mature reflection of God until the sixth day, right? And then the seventh day we have the rest that waits for the people of God. So what we have represented here, I believe, is similar to what we have represented, as we discussed in the allegory of the tabernacle, where we have an individual pass through the congregation before he can enter the wall of righteousness, fine linen, and approach the altar of burnt offering, baptism, right? You had to pass through that congregation and associate with Israel before you could enter that wall of righteousness, moral development, manifesting these works. Baptism isn't automatically just all of a sudden we come out of the waters of baptism and we have a natural desire within ourselves to do the things of the Word. It's a continual struggle the rest of our life, and it's We have to develop those characteristics before we enter the waters of baptism. We should begin to associate ourselves with the brethren, with those who believe these things, before we enter the waters of baptism, and we think that's what's shown here. The understanding of the word, association with those who believe it, then birth out of the water. We should feel a distance growing between us and our former associates of the world. We realize the vanity of their pursuits, while at the same time we're growing in our understanding of the eternal and lasting nature of the things we are learning of in the Word. As we grow in this understanding, our conscience prohibits us from participating in their endeavors and even in fellowship with them. Okay? We feel as Abraham in the parable who told the rich man, between us and you, and this is the distance that we should feel developed between us and the world as we grow in our understanding and our association with those of the truth. Between us and you, there is a great gulf fixed. There's an expanse between us. We've been energized to separate and pass through the heavens or the expanse and associate with these clouds. Between us and you, there is a great gulf fixed, is what the feeling that we should have with these earthly masses, so that they which would pass from hence to you cannot. Such rejection of our former manner of life and associates may bring reproach upon us, but continued attendance to the Word will enable us to maintain our position of separation, elevation above those earthly waters. Let's look at 1 Peter 4. First Peter 4, verse 3. For the time past of our life may suffice us to have wrought the will of the Gentiles when we walked in lasciviousness, lusts, excess of wine, revelings, banquetings, and abominable idolatries, wherein they think it strange that ye run not with them to the same excess of riot, speaking evil of you. And we need to consider this. Because I hear of things, people that, brethren, who don't have a problem with going and running to the same excess of riot that they did before their conversion. We should be spoken evil of because we won't run to the same excess of riot. And in closing, let's go down to verse 12. Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you, but rejoice inasmuch as ye are partakers of Christ's sufferings, that when His glory shall be revealed, ye may be glad also with exceeding joy. If ye be reproached for the name of Christ, happy are ye, for the Spirit of glory and of God resteth upon you. On their part He is evil spoken of, but on your part He is glorified. Thank you.